And welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum, the State versus Greg Lantz, Episode 5. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and part of the audio editing team at Undisclosed. And joining us today is a very special guest, Laura Nyreiter. She's clinical professor of law and co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law in Chicago. Nyreiter represents individuals who are wrongfully convicted of crimes when they were children or teenagers. Her clients have included Brendan Dassey, whose case was profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer, and of course, Laura was featured in the second chapter of that series, and Damien Echols of the West Memphis 3. Laura, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm such a huge fan of yours. I first, of course, got to know you on Making a Murderer, but I've followed your work since, and I'm just so happy and excited to talk to you.
Well, it's my honor to be here. I'm so thrilled to be here with the whole Undisclosed team, so thanks for having me.
Also with us is Rabia Chaudhry. She is anchoring this Greg Lantz series. She's the best-selling author of A Non-Story and, of course, all the other things that she is, including the best-smelling person that anyone has ever met. Hello, Rabia.
Hey, Rebecca. I got to put that in my bio.
And also with us, you might be able to tell from his laugh, is our very own legal Siri, associate dean and evidence professor at the South Carolina School of Law, Colin Miller. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm great. And I understand so are you, because there is some breaking undisclosed news that I want to talk about right here at the top with one of the cases you profiled on the podcast. Colin, can you fill us in on what's going on in that Willie Vesey case?
Willie Vesey is one of four cases out of Philadelphia we covered a few years ago. Willie Vesey was convicted of killing John Lewis in 1992 in North Philadelphia, despite the fact that he had a work alibi and the only eyewitness in the case was legally blind. And just today, October 9th, the Conviction Integrity Unit had presented its case to a judge in Philadelphia, and the judge agreed with both the DA's office and the Pennsylvania Innocence Project that Willie Vesey is innocent. And so 27 years after his wrongful conviction, he has been released and is going to see his family later today.
Wow. Amazing. Thoughts, Rabia?
Oh, just, I mean, we are 4-for-4 with Philly. It's fantastic. I mean, I was talking to Colin before we got on the call and saying, you know, yeah, there, obviously there have been like years of advocacy. His lawyers have done incredible jobs. The family's been supportive. And in all these cases, and of course, we've done our series on these cases, believing these men are innocent. But at the end of the day, if Larry Krasner hadn't been elected to that office, we might not have seen this result out of Philadelphia. I mean, Krasner has, I think there have been like 10 exonerations out of Philly in the last year. It's incredible. And so I just keep wanting to emphasize the power of the district attorney and what a difference it can make in a lot of the cases that we cover and that are out there and we can't cover.
So the Philadelphia series was four cases, right? And all four of those cases have now been...
They're all home.
They're all clear.
That's incredible.
And one of the things you might see in the reporting today, we touched upon it a bit in this series, these detectives, Devlin and Worrell, known as the Wacker Squad, essentially, we believe, beat and coerced confessions out of individuals, including Willie Vesey. And we didn't cover the coerced confession in this case based upon physical abuse so much because the CIU was investigating it. But in terms of how his interrogation went and sort of the mental state of Willie Vesey, there's a lot of overlaps between this case and the Brendan Dassey case that, of course, Laura has handled so well.
Now, Brendan, the Dassey case has also been in the news this week, including a very high-profile celebrity endorsement of him being released. Can you just talk about what the latest developments are there? How plugged in are you with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm happy to do it. So you're right. About a week ago, Steve Drizin and I and Seth Waxman and other members of Brendan's legal team filed a petition for executive clemency with the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Brendan, we all remember him, of course, from Making a Murderer, from those horrible interrogation videos that people saw on Netflix when he was a 16-year-old special education student. Brendan is 29 now. He's actually going to turn 30 on October 19th. So he has done 13 and a half years in prison. based on a confession that is almost universally regarded as false. You know, we came within about 12 hours of getting him out in 2016 when a judge in Milwaukee found significant doubts about the confession, threw it out, overturned the conviction. But that order releasing Brendan was blocked by a single vote in the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which found, among other things, that just because a confession is false doesn't mean you're legally entitled to get your conviction overturned. It's an incredible decision. The dissenting judges called it a profound miscarriage of justice. So that's why we're turning now to Governor Evers in Wisconsin, asking him to look at this case that the world recognizes as an injustice, but that the courts weren't able to fix, and to use his role as the executive of the state of Wisconsin, the sovereign powers that are entrusted to him by the Wisconsin Constitution, and issue either a commutation or a pardon to bring Brendan home.
Hmm. And now you've got Kim Kardashian calling for that as well, right?
We do. We were absolutely thrilled to see that Kim posted to her Instagram story and sent off two tweets in support of Brendan, publicizing an interview that he has done on the podcast Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom.
Which you were also on,
which
right?
I was also on, yes. But Brendan, this is the first interview he's given, the first time he has had an opportunity to tell his own story in his own voice, using his own words as best he can. So it's an incredible thing. You can listen to it at our website, which is bringbrendanhome.org. And you can also there sign a petition to Governor Evers urging him to bring Brendan home. We've already got more than 15,000 signatures, which is incredible. Mm. So we're very, very grateful for the support we've received from Kim and from all corners of the world, right? We've got former United States Solicitor General Seth Waxman. We've got the disability community, the juvenile justice community. We've got educators, and we've got amazing, good people all around the world, ordinary folks who just want to make their voices heard. So bringbrendanhome.org. Let's do this together.
And you've got all four members of the Crime Writers On team who have said from the beginning, all of us, like not a single one of us has any doubt as to Brendan's innocence or the awfulness and complete miscarriage of justice that was that confession. It's one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen in my many, many years of reporting on and talking about true crime. It's insane. And, you know, the whole thing with Kim Kardashian, just to sort of stay on that for a second, like, I am not one of these snobby people who thinks the Kardashians aren't important and don't matter. They are incredibly important in our culture for a variety of reasons. And the fact that she's using her platform for these kinds of statements, I find very impressive. I'm very grateful for it because I think it's incredible when somebody who's really in the mainstream, he talks about social justice issues. That is a very big deal, right?
I think it is. I think it's definitely a big deal. You know, we are very, very grateful for the same reason that you are. She has an incredible platform, and she's used that platform successfully to free, you know, what if I've sort of lost count at this point, is it 18 or 19 people, including somebody just 2 days ago? So she's got an incredible platform, an incredible ability to shine a spotlight onto cases of serious injustice. And, you know, we're thrilled that she's looking at Brendan's case.
Robbie, we've got to get Kim on the addendum. It's got to happen. How do we make this happen?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I remember seeing something about, oh, yeah, this was like a year ago when I was traveling overseas. And I think Kim Kardashian tweeted for the first time about listening to Serial. So,
yes.
Yeah, she right. That I'm not dreaming that.
No, you're not dreaming it. It happened.
So I don't know how far in she is. I will say this. I have a few times said something about her husband online, so I don't know if that was a really bad call.
We don't have to discuss that. We can just keep that off to the side.
I stopped saying anything. No, I'm kidding. I agree with you, Rebecca. I don't agree with people who are poo-pooing the work she's doing. I think it's important work, and I think she's using her platform for something incredible. If she has any kind of influence, power in this situation, whether it's even just to increase awareness, get support for these defendants, I don't care. I mean, it's use that power for good, you know.
That's awesome. Right. Yeah. That's right. And you can walk into the Oval Office, a place where like none of us wants to go right now. But if you're walking in for a good reason and you somehow have power there, which she apparently does, like, why not use it? Like, why not? So anyway, good on her.
Cooking is a big part of my life. I cook for my family at least two or three times a week, and quite frankly, I've been cooking for my family for about 25 years now. In fact, cooking is such a big part of my life that I'm currently working on a book, my next book, which will include a lot about my two decades of cooking. I really believe in reclaiming your time and your connection to your food by cooking with your own hands. But to do that, I also believe in having the right tools. That's why I love Equal Parts. I recently got the Equal Parts Everyday Knife. It's made of German steel, 8 inches. It is the best blade I've ever used. I am that person who I collect kitchen utensils because, you know, I use them a lot and they don't just lay around. I have a knife block, which is a pretty upscale set of knives I've gotten. I've gotten other kinds of knives over the years, but I have to say the Equal Parts Everyday Knife is the best knife I've ever owned. It's really lightweight. It just slices so sharply, and every one of my meals, almost every single one, because this is how it is when you make South Asian food, starts with slicing and frying onions. So I have been putting that knife to really good use in the last few weeks. But Equal Parts is not just about the products they sell. It's also about helping you get into the flow of home cooking with inviting cookware and coaching designed to introduce you to new ideas and keep you engaged with the entire process one step at a time. Look, the perfect recipe to make home cooking a fulfilling and rewarding experience is, number one, you start with cookware that's built from high quality, environmentally responsible materials. And two, you add Equal Parts coaching from real chefs who are standing by 7 days a week to provide one-on-one expertise and insight to every step of the cooking process. And yes, amazingly, that's what you get with Equal Parts. Then you can turn on some music, turn down the shades, and just enjoy yourself as you're doing your cooking. Because when you have the right cookware and techniques, cooking becomes a time to unplug, experiment, and have a great time. So get into the rhythm of the kitchen with friendly and inviting cookware, coaching, and guidance from Equal Parts, all with free shipping and free returns. Visit equalparts.com and get $50 off any cookware kit over $200 with the code undisclosed. By the way, this also makes a great gift for people in your life who love to cook or people in your life who would love to learn how to cook. Once again, visit equalparts.com and get $50 off any cookware kit over $200 if you use the code undisclosed. That's equalparts.com. Enter the code undisclosed.
All right, let's get back to the subject at hand, episode 5 of Undisclosed, the State versus Greg Lance. First, a synopsis of the episode. In episode 5, Undisclosed looks at 4 witnesses who, fairly early on in the investigation, gave statements to authorities that incriminate Greg Lance. Each of these witnesses will also end up testifying against him at trial 2 years later, and that's particularly damaging to the defense because each is either a friend or close acquaintance of Greg's. The episode examines the internal inconsistencies in the witness statements, as well as discrepancies between their statements and those that are used to corroborate them, such as the statements of Mike Snow and his girlfriend Danielle. The statements by Rocky Harmon and Keith Herbstreit are particularly damning because they are both close friends of Greg and both help establish, as does Mike Snow, that Greg had premeditated the murders. These witnesses allege Greg was seeking to kill the Kolesnikovs months prior to their murders, had attempted to hire someone to kill them, had suggested burning down someone else's property to solve another legal dispute, and had repeatedly brought up that victims needed to be taken care of. Keith Herbstreit, initially a suspect, is given a polygraph and passes, though his car is seized and held for months, and he ends up giving authorities multiple statements as well as agreeing to tape recording statements between himself and Greg, which don't really provide anything incriminating. But Keith is most valuable because he's able to connect Greg to the green cord and flashlight found on the gun, which investigators were not able to connect him to until now. Now, you know, I edit the episode, so I listened to it very carefully. That cord connection seemed very tenuous to me. Is that my imagination?
It's not your imagination because it is incredibly common cord. I mean, I feel like almost everybody, I think I've owned that kind of cord like numerous times in my life. It's like this green nylon looking rope thingy. Mm-hmm. It's just very common. And, you know, one thing that I don't think was mentioned in this, but I was going to lay it out kind of in the timeline in the next episode, but I'll go ahead and mention it here. It was, they had actually found a bunch of this cord at Greg's house, like in the yard, which is precisely what Keith was talking about. He had like thrown some cord up, he had tied it some firecrackers, but beyond the fact that it's very common, what he manages to do is say, this cord that's tied to the gun has like these dark spots on it that are burn spots. And that cord at Greg's house had burn spots on it probably because I tied firecrackers to it. And so it was not just that it was green cord, but also that they had a way of explaining those dark blotches.
Right. But the cord, if it was the murder weapon, would have had burn spots on it because there was a fire there.
But also, we don't know if they're burn spots. Right. It could be dirt. That's we have no idea what it is.
That's a good point. So that's a powerful witness statements here. Even when those statements, you know, don't provide a lot of information about a defendant's direct connection with a crime, like they don't place him at the crime scene. You don't have an actual taped phone call of him saying, yeah, I did it to his friend. But these witness statements are powerful. Colin, I'm wondering first if you can just comment on that about, you know, just the power, especially getting people that know the, you know, alleged perp to testify against them in court and to give statements to the cops.
Yeah. So 2 points on that. First, having someone who is friends or family with a defendant is absolutely much more powerful than someone who's in an adversarial position to the defendant or is a stranger. We saw that in the Rocky Myers case out of Alabama, the man who was convicted of murder and his friend was the one who is implicating him and has now since recanted. And the point by the defense was to say a friend testifying against a defendant is much more powerful than someone, again, who is a stranger or not a family member. And the second part, Rebecca, is that, you know, oftentimes these sort of circumstantial statements are more powerful than the directly incriminatory ones because, you know, you can often write off and say, oh, this person is being pressured to testify or they're trying to implicate this person. Whereas sort of the more casual statements that indirectly involve the defendant, a jury looking that often would say, oh, well, why would a person make that up? You know, you could see why they would make up a person's direct involvement, but to say, oh, he made these statements or might have had a motive, et cetera, those are often tougher to write off than the actually accusatory statements.
Laura, do you have thoughts about that, the power of these witness statements, especially when they come from, you know, friends or family members of the defendant? Have you had experience with anything like that in cases you've worked on?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, witness statements can be very, very powerful evidence of guilt, and there's no doubt about that. It's a commonly used form of evidence, but it's also a form of evidence that is commonly seen in wrongful conviction cases, too. You know, mistaken statements or inaccurate statements by eyewitnesses are a leading cause of wrongful convictions. So when you see a situation like this, where people are giving statements, are making statements about what they heard somebody say or the, you know, sort of peripheral facts of the case here, we have to really dive into how those statements were obtained from these witnesses to understand how they were questioned, what the circumstances of their questioning were. It's not unlike a confession case where you're getting a statement from a suspect. Here, we're getting statements from witnesses. And the question is, what was said to them? What was the context of the situation that produced those statements?
You know, something I think about a lot is if, and I think a lot about listening to this, but I thought about it watching the Making a Murderer documentary and all a lot of the things that we've looked at where I believe people were wrongfully convicted. So, for instance, I had an argument with my husband last night. That's a true story. I really did. It was like about something stupid. But of course, as these things do, they get like way bigger than they actually are. And of course, we immediately sort of like apologized today, but whatever. And I then came to work this morning before we had apologized and told my coworker that I had had an argument with my husband. Now, if he ended up dead, okay. And my work, hypothetically, and my coworker was called in to the police, to talk to the police. And they said to her, we have other evidence that Rebecca murdered Kevin. What can you tell me about anything she may have said or done at work today? Like, is that what you're talking about? That they give context to make the friends or family think there's more and that they are just adding to a puzzle rather than they are the whole puzzle?
No, that's not what I'm talking about there. Not really in terms of the provision of context for the reason that they're being questioned as potential witnesses. What I'm talking about is, you know, the kind of thing that we see on Making a Murderer or When They See Us or any of these other shows that have recently featured interrogations. I'm talking about the disclosure of facts to witnesses who are then incentivized to repeat those facts back, to adopt the police's narrative. Something we saw really, really clearly with my client, Brendan Dassey, when he was unable to describe the murder of Teresa Halbach until his interrogators told him that she had been shot in the head. And it's something that we see with witness statements as well. If your friend was brought in and had no idea, you know, you hadn't actually made that statement to your friend. Your friend was brought in and said, no, you know, Rebecca never said anything to me about this. And then the police said to her, well, you know, we think that Rebecca told you that her husband had been shot in the head, you know, and then she repeated that back. I think that kind of situation would be a big red flag.
Right, right. And Colin, we know that these eyewitness statements are often connected to wrongful conviction cases. How are they, you know, in what way are they still considered evidence? I mean, just can you just describe like how they can reach that bar where they are admissible? Is it because they have two and three and four of them and they're able to put them together to make a circumstantial case? Or is that in question sometimes, whether or not statements are actually evidence?
Yeah, well, and the answer is, you know, if we look at the system of evidence rules in this country, we're very much a pro-admissibility country. And that's to say that historically, under the common law, there were categories of witnesses who weren't allowed to testify. So a spouse couldn't testify on behalf of their spouse, an atheist couldn't testify, a person with prior felony convictions couldn't testify. The modern trend is basically...
Wait, did you say an atheist couldn't testify?
Atheists could not testify, right. If a person...
Because they couldn't swear on a Bible, they were considered...
Right. They refused to take the oath. They were not allowed to testify. The modern trend is we generally allow witnesses to testify, and then we can impeach them based upon their changing story, their prior convictions, et cetera. There are exceptions. The big move now is to have reliability hearings for informants to see whether they can testify or not. But eyewitnesses sort of fall into that broad category of if they come in and say, I saw something or I heard something, as long as they have firsthand knowledge and they're willing to either do the oath or an affirmation, they're generally allowed to testify, and it's all about calling into question their credibility, but they are competent to testify.
Colin, let me ask you though, let me follow up with that. I mean, how does then the hearsay rule apply when somebody is just testifying to, oh, I heard this, or I, you know?
Yeah, and so the answer is we have the rule against hearsay, which says that out-of-court statements are generally not admissible to come in to prove the truth of the matter asserted. However, we have hearsay exceptions, and we have hearsay exclusions, and what I always teach my students is, we always hear about hearsay, 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 it can't come in. And of course, it's been in the news a lot in the context of the impeachment inquiry. But there are so many exceptions where you're saying the statement is not coming in to prove the truth of the matter asserted, or we have, you know, present sense impressions, excited utterances, we have public documents, we have a current state of mind. There are so many exceptions that the baseline presumption is these statements are coming in as opposed to being excluded.
Now, Robbie, you have no experience in anything you've ever worked on or talked about or been on an HBO documentary about witness statements from friends and acquaintances of a suspect, do you?
Right. No, I've never encountered that before. But by the way, can I just first say, Rebecca, this is at least the sixth time I've heard you make an example of just in case Kevin died.
And yes. I'm covering my bases.
I feel like, you know... It's also a brilliant move if you were planning it, because you're yes. Like, would I have put that out there? Anyway.
No, I wouldn't have. Of course not. Sorry, Kevin. If you ever listen to this, yeah. Which you probably won't because, you know, you're busy. If you ever do, I promise there's no other plan in motion here.
Not yet. Also, I wanted to add, you know, Colin mentioned one of the cases. Was it the Rocky Myers case? But also the Chester Holman case we saw, in which Chester's friend, who was sitting with him in the car that night, who knew that none of what the police said happened that same night, you know, gave a false confession implicating Chester. So, and because she's a friend of his, you know, yeah, that it does carry more weight. But, you know, with the non, and I think it's the point you brought up, Rebecca, is important. It is not uncommon for cops to go to witnesses. And I always actually wonder when you have statements like these that are not directly like tying the suspect to a crime, like none of those witnesses are saying, I saw him with a gun, or I saw him commit the crime, or I saw him at the crime scene, or any of that, how common it is for officers to say, by the way, we have solid evidence. Like we have DNA, we already have stuff that's connecting him to the crime. We saw this with the Nunn's case where all the students were told that there's DNA evidence linking Adnan to the crime before they were interviewed, after they arrested him, before they were interviewed. And then, so now you have these witnesses giving their statements in light of what they think is incontrovertible evidence. And I think you do see that. And then they'll end up just kind of like, they're like, oh, okay, well, if he definitely did it, they've got definite proof, then I got to figure out, you know, then everything
they're trying to help. Like, exactly. it seems like a lot of those kids were legitimately trying to help something they thought was already sort of a done thing. Yeah. And they thought, oh, do I have something to add to this? Or maybe they just, you know, some of them thinking less positively, just like kind of want to be a part of the story. Like, I have something to add. Not thinking they're doing harm, but just, you know.
We all do it. We all do it when we're faced with something like this. We all think back and think, oh, yeah, that looked guilty and that looked bad.
Right. Or even something less nefarious. Someone at your job gets fired or disappears all of a sudden. You're like, oh, that might be connected to this weird thing that happened 3 weeks. You know what I mean? We all do it. It's not uncommon for us to sort of fill in those details. So I don't know. I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me was in that taped, was it Keith Herbstreit who taped the call and basically told Greg, like, hey, man, we're friends, but, you know, I can't, you know, I can't help you anymore. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it sounded like Greg was just like, no, I get it. And from Greg's side, it was very much like, yeah, I get that you don't want to be involved with this stupid police investigation. Like, who would want to be? He wasn't saying, like, yes, I am guilty and you don't have to lie for me, Keith, right? But Keith is kind of in the frame too. So how does he go from being like potential suspect to like witness? I mean, how does that happen?
I think he goes from being suspect to witness when he is able to be valuable to the police. And Keith knows he's a suspect because they've got his car. That's a lot of pressure right there, right? They keep hauling him in. Although in one interview they say, oh, that he just called himself and said, I have something to say. I mean, come on. Yeah. So I think that Keith knew that the pressure was on him and that he did take his polygraph and he failed. And I mean, like, so I think he could see that he was in danger here if he didn't become state's witness. And I think when he became state's witness is when he stopped being a suspect.
Well, and you know, one thing that's really interesting, by the way, guys, about how Keith was questioned, you know, you mentioned during your episode that while Keith is being questioned during one of these interviews, they ask him these questions, you know, can you think of any justification for someone to kill, right? When we catch them, can you think of any reason why the killer here should get a break or a second chance? What should happen to someone who commits a crime like this? What's really interesting to me is that those are interrogation techniques. Those are what are called behavior-provoking questions that are lifted verbatim from the Reed Techniques book, Criminal Interrogation and Confessions. These are questions that officers are trained by the Reed Technique people, Johnny Reed and Associates, to ask to determine whether or not someone is lying. So I'm actually, I've got the book open in front of me right now, and there's instructions here, right? If you ask somebody about what should happen to the person who committed the offense, it says an innocent subject will generally suggest a reasonably harsh treatment for the guilty, considering the seriousness of the offense. So typical responses from an innocent subject are, he should be sent to prison. I hope they prosecute him, send him to jail. But it says a guilty subject has a difficult time discussing possible serious consequences for his crime. Therefore, his response could be, that's not up to me. That's up to a judge to decide. It depends. And of course, what you have here is Keith responding to that question, what should happen to the person who committed this crime? He says something like, you know, it doesn't affect me. I have no opinion.
Right.
And according to the Reed Technique, that's supposed to be a clear-cut sign of deception that you should take into consideration in proceeding with the interview.
Right.
So I think it's very, very clear that these interrogators were proceeding with Keith, at least at that point, using the Reed Technique, which is an interrogation technique. It's crystal clear that they were considering him a suspect and trying to make judgments about whether he was telling the truth or being deceptive. Now, there's been a ton of research since the Reed Technique was invented that tests these behavior provoking questions and other similar aspects of the interview techniques that they put out there that tries to answer, tries to assess whether or not the Reed Technique is actually good at determining truth tellers from liars. And a lot of these techniques that are being sold as infallible, as perfect ways of discriminating between truth tellers and liars, they're seriously questioned by a lot of the research that's out there. So I wouldn't hang our hats on the fact that he's answering in a way that Reed says is deceptive, but I would hang your hats on the fact that these interrogators were lifting those questions straight from the Reed manual and asking him those questions to determine whether or not he was lying or telling the truth.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I'm completely fascinated. I want that manual. I want to read it just so I can like find out, you know, all the times and, you know, that I've watched other things where people have been using those questions. That's really, really interesting. Now, can we guess what's happening during an interrogation or interview when it's many, many hours long, but the notes don't reflect that length of time or only tape record or videotape part of it, including the secretly recorded conversations between witnesses and Greg Lance, but they noticeably didn't tape record interviews where it seems more hours pass than the notes would suggest. It's just like there's a lot missing here, and I don't know if there's anything that we can glean from that. Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I've spoken on this with Richard Leo, who's a professor at University of San Francisco, who's sort of an expert in this field, and he's actually looked, speaking of our Philadelphia cases, at the practices in Philadelphia, both before and after they started recording these interrogations. And it's kind of all the things you might expect. Basically, in some situations, it's police getting a person to make a statement, and then you Mirandize them, and then you get them to repeat the statement to sort of get around giving them Miranda warnings before the interview. It's a lot of, you know, and of course we can see this in the Brendan Dassey case, and we can see it in the Willie Vesey case. The initial statement is contradicting the evidence that we have on record, and it's the police working this witness through the statement off the record so that they get the facts that are consistent with the facts and evidence we know. And so we don't see the what's called the pre-interview, where basically they're sharing their information and getting it to jive with the statement by this witness. So it's essentially how the sausage is made, but we don't see it when we have these brief notations about a rather lengthy interview that we have.
You're exactly right, Colin. I mean, it's nuts. You know, when I started doing this work, only three states required interrogations to be electronically recorded. And, you know, thanks to the work of, you know, people like you, like people like Richard and people across the country, we're now up to 26 states. But that still leaves 24 states that don't require the complete recording of police interrogations. And when you don't have a record that is complete and clear as to what happened in the interrogation room, you know, you have to ask yourself why that is, and start digging into the reasons that you've offered as possibilities out there.
I always have a question about witness statements. I know it's probably done differently in different jurisdictions, but, you know, we're used to seeing like on NYPD Blue or whatever, when someone confesses, they just push a pen over the desk and they say, write that down and sign it or whatever. But isn't it also sometimes just like the cop's summary of what was said during the conversation and they have the person sign it? Does that also happen in some jurisdictions?
Yeah, it happens different ways in different places. I've seen, you know, of course, there's Brendan, which is on video. It's a full videotaped, you know, oral confession. Sometimes it's the cop's summary that they push across the table and have you sign. Sometimes they have you write out a statement that they dictate based, you know, in theory on the conversation that you had with them earlier. So it can take a bunch of different forms. What's interesting to me is when you see these written statements that are shaped by the interrogators. There are tricks of the trade in writing a statement like that, right? That police often do. They will often insert mistakes into a written confession that the person who's signing the confession is then told to cross out and correct, because it makes the final statement look that much more believable and that much more like it comes from the confessor.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So there's a lot of tricks of the trade in there in generating these confessions. They can take a bunch of different forms, but there's, you know, a lot of different ways to do this in a way that, and it's all designed to make it look more credible after the fact.
And the other thing is, like, you'll see statements that are supposed to be the witness themselves giving a statement, and they will then sign it. So it's like kind of the first person type of thing. It's shocking to me, like in certain cases where I've seen, I'm like, why does every single witness have the exact same handwriting? It's because the detective wrote the note, the statement. But in this case, mostly what we have when we don't have transcripts are not even like the witness giving a statement. It is basically the investigator just providing notes of their conversation with. And so that adds another layer of, I mean, like there's the witness doesn't then have power to go back and look at those notes and say this is accurate or not accurate in that moment. They just don't.
Right.
No, that's right. So what I would do in a case like that, where you have, you know, the only written information, the only written documentation you have of these statements, I would go ahead and literally make a list, a bullet point list of the details that appear in the sort of final statement as encapsulated in those notes. And I would ask myself, when I look at the details that the suspect is supposedly providing, I would say, are they adding anything to the story that the police didn't already know or believe to be true? Right? If this witness's story somehow magically tracks only those details that the police already believe to be true based on their prior investigation, to me, that's suspect. Right? A magical match between what was already believed to be true and what the witness is now saying. On the other hand, if the witness is able to lead the police to some new undiscovered piece of evidence, that the police did not previously know about and that can be objectively verified as linked to the crime, you know, that's an indicator of reliability. So it's all about kind of tracing those details. Where did they come from? What does this witness add? And really getting down and dirty with the details of the statement.
But Laura, retracted witness statements are often instrumental in exonerations too, right? Like, so how do people often come to a place where they retract? Are they just looking at what they said and saying, I didn't say that? Or do they come out and say, I lied when I said that? Like, what are the most common circumstances around those retracted statements?
Yeah, well, it can happen a bunch of different ways. I've been involved in cases like the Robert Davis case out of Virginia, in which witnesses who said incredibly damning things at the time of trial, have sat with that for years and years and years, and it's a matter of conscience for them to come forward. They sent letters in that case to Robert's lawyer recanting in full their statements, saying this has weighed on our minds. You know, he's been in prison for years. We just need to come clean, make a clean breast of it. And those were letters that Robert's lawyer received out of the blue. There have been other situations in which investigators, private investigators, have gone out to find trial witnesses years after the fact, and talked to them and given them the opportunity to either affirm what they said previously or, you know, make changes to it if they think it's right. But what strikes me in these cases, in many of these cases, is that it is a matter of conscience for a lot of witnesses. Mm. A lot of people have been sitting with, you know, the fact that they said things that, you know, maybe at the time seemed like the only thing to say. Maybe they didn't feel as though they had a choice as to say those things. But it's, it's been weighing on them. I've had people in my own cases, witnesses I've found, who have said things to me like, I've been waiting 12 years for you to come find me. I have nightmares about this to this day. I still ask how anybody could ever have believed me. But there are people who felt in the moment that they had no choice but to say the things that they thought their questioners wanted to hear, and they're eager to unburden themselves.
It's interesting. A cold case investigator once told me around a book we were writing about a case that was solved 20 years after it happened, that the same is true for people who don't come forward when a crime happens, that over time, what seemed so high stakes about not interacting with the cops, about wanting to keep a secret for a friend or something like that, over time, people can't live with it. They come forward and they realize it was, you know, in the case of the book we wrote, a kid committed a crime when he was in high school and his friends all helped him cover it up. And 20 years later, they were professionals. They were doctors and veterinarians and lawyers and accountants. And the stakes had changed when the police came knocking again. Like, it wasn't worth it for them to not say something. You know what I mean? So time really is an investigator's friend in certain cases. And it sounds like time is also the friend of potential exonerees. Colin, is that something that you've noticed too in the cases that you've worked on?
Yeah, well, you know, we're expecting any day now an update in the Joseph Webster case out of Nashville. And that is very much exactly what you're discussing. There is a witness who essentially has said Joseph Webster is innocent and his stepbrother, Kenny Neal, is guilty of this crime. She was not willing to come forward at the time. She was afraid of both interacting with the police as well as Kenny Neal. And now as the years have passed and she's seen Joseph Webster wrongfully in prison for over a decade, she's come forward. She's willing to speak. She's worked with the CIU there in Nashville. And, you know, we're hopeful there'll be an exoneration soon there. But yeah, we've seen that in a number of cases, something like that, where at the time interacting with the police seems like the worst thing in the world. But then as the years of wrongful conviction build up, these people who are often in better positions and professionals are now willing to speak.
I think that's such an underestimated factor in so many investigations is the lengths people will go to, people who don't have regular contact with the police, the lengths they will go to not have contact with the police. It's really like onerous to think about going and talking to the cops about a thing like you worry you're going to mess up. It's, you know, disruptive to like your life in certain ways. You just don't want that to be a part of your personal story. You know, I was a witness in a case. I helped convict somebody or helped exonerate somebody. I mean, I think that's an underestimated factor when it comes to it's very easy to backseat quarterback and say, why didn't anyone say anything or why, you know. But I actually think it's kind of easier to understand than most people think.
It's not an easy thing to come forward as a witness in a case because it's not like you're just going to have one interaction and you're done. You might be interviewed multiple times. You might have to then testify. You don't know how much time and energy effort is going to take from your life. And, you know, sometimes you also kind of don't know. You know, I mean, think about Asia. Some witnesses actually are not quite sure if they're even important in a case. But even if they do think, I mean, I think they figure if I am important enough, somebody will come find me.
What I think is really interesting is the way that the legal system is arranged is exactly contrary to everything you guys are saying right now, right? Our legal system is designed to elevate, to make most important, to make most crucial the moment of the trial itself, if there is a trial, and to incentivize everybody in the system to come forward with the truth at that time. That's why it's so hard to overturn convictions after the fact, based on recantations, based on new evidence. The system wants to incentivize all the evidence to come out truthfully at the time of trial. But of course, we know from the world of wrongful convictions that that's just not how this works. And you guys have put your finger on a number of really great reasons why witnesses may not be telling the truth or may feel pressure to not be fully forthcoming at the time of trial. But after the passage of time, that changes and more to the story comes out.
How successful are recanted witness statements in overturning convictions? Is that like a primary driver of overturned convictions? Is it not common? Laura, what's your experience on that?
It really varies. It varies from state to state. You know, here in Illinois, the black letter law of the state is that witness recantations are inherently unreliable. So it is a matter of law here in Illinois that if you recant, even if you do it perfectly, give a perfect detailed explanation of why you said what you said, what has changed, why you're coming forward now, it's inherently unreliable under the law here in Illinois. But there are many other cases, of course, including some here in Illinois, despite the law. There are many cases that have turned on recantations and many exonerations that have resulted from recantations. So I think at the end of the day, it has to do with how powerful is the recantation itself? What reasons does the witness give for having changed his or her story? What corroboration is there for the new story that the witness may be telling? What lack of corroboration was there for the previous story? And how the recantation itself fits into the larger case as a whole.
Right. Colin, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting because in Pennsylvania, I would say recanted statements are treated with the most antipathy among a state across the entire country. There's a long common law tradition that's been carried over to today where Pennsylvania treats recanted statements with much skepticism. And in the actual legal court system, that means recantations almost never lead to exonerations. Sort of the blessing we've had in this case, and Rabia can comment on this too, is Larry Krasner taking over and reinvigorating the CIU there, because recantations in that context, Chester Holman, among others, Terrence Lewis case, Larry Krasner in his office looks at these and says, I don't care what the court system has to say. We as the DA's office are looking at these recantations among other evidence, and we're perfectly fine coming into court and saying these people are likely innocent. And so CIU's recantations are great. In the court system in Pennsylvania, they're absolutely terrible for getting convictions overturned.
All right. Well, we do have a couple of listener comments and questions. This one is from Tommy Dillon, who says, hey, guys, I've been listening to the podcast and in episode 3, Heron Farm, it says Joe, who has a bad eye, could not make the license plate out, but could see that it was a Humphreys County plate. I wonder if you guys thought it was odd that he could make out the small print where the county is printed on the tag, but could not make out the large print. Keep up the good work. Rabia, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like, so I actually have a picture of the car that Joe later identified as he thinking it was the same or similar to the one he had seen. And you have the plates there and you can see the numbers are much bigger. They're red against a white background than the smaller font that says Humphreys underneath it. So they seem like they'd be more prominent. Joe had one bad eye. Apparently he never got out of his car to actually look closely at the red car. But I mean, on one hand, I can see how it seems ridiculous that the letters that are like four times the size of Humphreys, he didn't see the tag numbers. But on the other hand, if you're familiar with like a tag that's from a certain county, you kind of don't even have to read it. You can, you know, like when I'm driving down the road, if I see a certain looking license plate, I know already it's a Maryland license plate because of,
right.
You know what I mean? Like a picture on it or something that's.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it could be that that's how he identified it without actually being able to read Humphreys, but yeah. Just knowing that Humphreys is written in a certain way, it's, you know, so yes and no.
It's like the moose plate here in New Hampshire. You know, somebody has it because like the numbers are off to the side instead of in the middle because there's a picture of a moose on it.
Right,
it's like something you just see.
You can just identify it.
Exactly. So Colin, Amanda, a listener, Amanda Krasinski wants to know, first of all, she says before this podcast and in the Dark Season 2, the Curtis Flowers case, she had no idea that the bullet forensic science was junk science. So you guys are doing your job, teaching people stuff every single week. But she wants to know, any idea when we can expect, quote, experts to not be allowed to testify about bullets specifically coming from a specific gun? Colin, is there any movement on that, given all the research and stuff we've been hearing about in these podcasts?
Not really. Comparative bullet lead analysis has been shown basically to be junk science. And yet, certainly in Tennessee, where this case took place, experts still come in and give this testimony. We still have experts coming in and testifying about bite mark comparisons, despite that being shown to be junk science. There's a huge inertia with expert testimony, where despite a number of studies, the NAS report, the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology, saying that a lot of this comparison evidence does not have a basis in science, it still comes in and you can challenge it and tell the jury there are issues with it, but there isn't a huge push to have this evidence excluded that's been successful to this point.
So, Laura, one of the things that we've seen over and over again in the media, in the stories that Undisclosed has covered, is that experts come into court, and even when what it is they're testifying to is questioned about the science or, you know, the non-contamination of samples or stuff like that, pattern forensics, very often their credential and the way they get the jury to trust them or the prosecutor to say they're trustworthy is just by saying, yeah, I'm an expert. I've been doing this for 20 years. That's how I know it's true. Have you encountered that? Is that a thing that happens in courtrooms where you are?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a problem when there's an expert witness in the courtroom who is trying to, you know, serve as the voice of authority, the voice of reason, the voice of experience on a certain issue is something that most people know nothing about, like ballistics or blood spatter or whatever other forensic issue that they're talking about. You know, I think it's really important in situations like that to make sure that both sides have access to expert witnesses. I think that's a huge part of the structural issue here, is that public defenders often have a really hard time getting the funding to pay for witnesses, for experts of their own, even to rebut state experts. And that's a huge thing that can be done and needs to be done through legislation, through policy change. Make those funds available to both sides so that both sides can hire the best experts to vet the science, vet the facts of the case, and really try to get at the truth of what happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love the original documentary, The Staircase, so much, because that was such a well-funded defense where they were able to do that. And yet it still showed some bias towards state's experts in that case because, you know, ultimately, like the blood spatter expert the state brought up, he was lying. Like he just made up fake tests and did fake stuff, you know, and the defense had Henry Lee on their side. And originally that, you know, there was a conviction obtained in that case. It's crazy. But yes, I agree with you. And I know that my co-podcaster, Laura Bricker, who was a defense investigator for many years, is always saying the same, would also agree with you there, that there should be equity in terms of experts on both sides. Colin, is there anything like being talked about in terms of that in the criminal justice system anywhere? Or is that just something that's just not going to happen?
There's not much movement. I just, you know, I had a recent graduate from South Carolina here who's a public defender, and it's one of these cell terrapin cases, and he's trying to retain his own expert. And at least here in South Carolina, it's just a matter of, if you're a public defender, you have to petition and say why this forensic expert is important. And in rare cases, you get that and you get the funding to be able to hire them. In most cases, you don't. And so, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there's talks about equal pay for prosecutors and public defenders, but there's not really a huge push in terms of allowing public defenders to get these experts to counteract what the state's saying.
So, Laura, I understand that you have to leave us now. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, lending your expertise and your voice to this story and telling us about all the stuff that's going on with Brendan Dassey. I know I think about you a lot and his case all the time, so I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been speaking with you about it.
Thank you guys so much. It's been an absolute honor to be here.
Thanks, Laura. So, Rabia, Amanda had another question. Amanda Krasinski, she wants to know where the Greg Lance case currently stands in the courts and whether or not you've been able to talk to any of Lance's friends who testified for the prosecution. Are we going to be hearing them in the podcast?
So we're going to talk about procedurally where it is when we wrap up the season. And in terms of at least these four witnesses, two, unfortunately, are no longer living. Hmm. And two of them, let's say, I don't know how to respond directly. I haven't spoken to them directly, but I know people who know people type of thing.
Okay. So
not yet.
For,
not yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Got it. Yeah. Got it. And was there any defense expertise or, you know, opportunity for defense expertise around the bullets? I know that we know the bullet science is junk, but was there any opportunity for the defense to refute it? That's what Zingo Anderson asked for you.
Well, actually, that is precise. Well, that's one of the many things we're going to be talking about next week's episode. We're going to be talking about the trial.
Colin, there's some other news around you. You recently filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Very big deal there. Can you talk about that? I'd love to hear what was in that brief.
Yeah, so this is a case out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so New Mexico police come to an apartment complex to arrest this woman, Kayenta Jackson, involved in drug dealing. And they come upon two women standing next to an FJ Cruiser. One runs inside. The other, Roxanne Torres, who is not at all a suspect in this case, gets in the FJ Cruiser and starts driving away. The police officers pull out their guns. They shoot her twice, but she's able to escape and not stop her vehicle. She turns around and sues the Albuquerque Police Department for excessive force. And what the courts in New Mexico and then federal court hold is, to state a claim for excessive force, you have to prove a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and that there's no seizure if there is force, but no submission to that force. In other words, they shoot her, but she drives away. There's a split. Some courts allow it, some courts don't. And so on behalf of a bunch of law professors from around the country, we submitted this amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, to the Supreme Court, asking them to hear this case, saying it's essentially ridiculous that you can have police officers shooting people who are not even suspects in the case, and yet they can't recover on a claim of excessive force. So we should know in the next few weeks or months whether the Supreme Court agrees to hear this case.
Wow. How many times have you filed amicus briefs with the Supreme Court, Colin? Is this, it's not your first rodeo, is it?
I think this is the sixth. I think it's the sixth time. Yeah.
Wow. Well, we should all be so lucky.
I'm
going to
start filing my own.
I think you should.
I'll probably get banned.
Any listeners, you see a case that's being argued at the Supreme Court, you don't have to be an attorney. You can be anyone who has.
Oh, no, the floodgates are about to open.
Hey, you know.
It's really, really interesting. Well, Colin, I love following your work online. Honestly, I think anybody who's interested in criminal justice who doesn't follow you on Twitter or read your blog or just like look you up on Google every few days, they are super missing out, not just around the cases you cover on the podcast, but around everything that you talk about in the legal field, in precedent, in what courts around the country are doing. You really are just like a law professor to us all. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah. And Rebecca, to put in a plug, actually following up on, you know, Willie Vesey, Terrence Lewis, Sean Thomas, Chester Holman, I just submitted a draft brief to Representative Chris Rabb in Pennsylvania. He's going to file it later this year. It's trying to get an exoneration compensation law to provide these men compensation for their years of wrongful conviction. Pennsylvania is one of the few states that doesn't have one. And so we will certainly later in the year be making a call on listeners to call your representatives in Pennsylvania and ask them to support this bill.
Wow, that's really great. It's a really great piece of work that you're doing. Rabia, I have to tell you, I am still loving producing this series. The Greg Lance case is fascinating in no small part because there are so many different elements to it. You know, the weapon, the witnesses, the setting, the colorful characters that you've talked to on the podcast. Thank you so much for putting it together so beautifully and for once again talking to me about it this week. It's been really fun.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. This case is just so interesting to me. And like every day I learn something new. I'm like, wait, what? But before we sign off, I do want to give a big congratulations on behalf of the entire Undisclosed team to our executive producer, Meetal Thelhan. I don't think we've got a chance to do that at the top of the show. Meetal had a baby girl yesterday. So welcome to the world, baby Rhea.
Yes. And Meetal was still emailing us like after she had her baby, which was insane. Like
Had a baby. Yeah, it's crazy.
Like, yeah, I was looking at the timing of like your tweet about the baby and I'm like, I think I got an email from Meetal after that about how to connect with Laura on Skype. Like,
totally
what
did.
Is she doing?
You totally did. I mean, hours after she gave birth, she was messaging me about this addendum, today's addendum. I'm like, Meetal, stop.
Yes.
Get some rest.
And I know we say it in the credits, and I just don't think we've ever said it on the show enough. Methyl is the engine that powers this whole machine. Like, yes. Nothing would happen without her. Her work is incredible. It's meticulous. She keeps everyone informed. She keeps everyone wrangled. She makes sure everything is where it's supposed to be. She solves problems. She gives feedback. And she's a hell of a funny and nice person. I adore her. And I think we all do, right?
Yes, absolutely. We all love you, Methyl. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lantz series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod, and you can ask questions for future Addendum episodes on Twitter or Facebook. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum. Remember, the sponsors make it possible for the Undisclosed team to continue doing their work. So please support all the sponsors you hear on this show and on regular episodes of Undisclosed. Our executive producer is the great Methyl Telhan. Audio production for the Addendum is done by the wonderful and talented Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song is by the talented Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture review podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. That one is a lot of fun. Special thanks to my partner in crime and life and the guy I keep threatening to kill on these shows, Kevin Flynn. You've been picking up a lot of my work so I could host this series, and it's basically a dream come true. So thanks for that. Also, thanks to Rabia, Susan, and Colin, who continue to make Undisclosed a fulfilling and fun part of my podcasting work life. On behalf of everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.